to establish that for Yadav, to whom the letter was sent. Saka opened up Ukra'ah and read it. Harez the Kishaleach Yadav Pikadov. It's like an individual who's given his place a safeguard and he somehow abuses the item. Shaleach literally means he cast his hand against it. The law is, of course, if I'm giving an item for safeguarding, so then as a watchman, I have to keep it watched. And if I might, of course, have to watch it from other people, but I also have to make sure not to damage it myself, because that's always a possibility. So therefore, if I do something, for example, which like move it when I'm not supposed to, or put it somewhere where I can't, I'm not supposed to, or even had a thought to actually, you know, I shouldn't say this is a thought, but you had a thought while you're moving it in a normal fashion to steal it from the guy, so then you become liable for all damages which occur subsequently. In other words, at that point, even though a watchman is exempt from certain types of damages, since we're shaleach yad, since you abused the object by doing something which you weren't supposed to do with it, or having an improper intent at the time you were doing something with it, so from that time on, you are liable not just for the regular obligations which a watchman has, but for even more obligations, you are tantamount to a thief. Okay, so just like a thief has to make restitution under any and all conditions, the object is gone, of course, he makes monetary restitution, so to this individual, one who received it as a watchman, once he abused that watch, and he was shaleach, yeah, he cast his hand against it, so he is required to make all compensation under all circumstances. So here, too, there's somebody who wanted to contend that that if you open the letter when you are the mailman to take it, so you are, that you got the mailman is like a watchman. He's a guard, he's guarding this letter. So if he opens it up to read it, it's an illicit use of the object. So it's an illicit use of the object, so therefore, he actually is, in that case, considered to be like a thief, and therefore he is liable, whatever liable means in this case, but it certainly means that it's a prohibited thing to do. Now, there's several flaws in this argument, which is why it had Rabbeinu Gershom actually have to make a decree, and it wasn't automatically forbidden because of the principle of shaleach yadav because of somebody casting his hand against this object, given to watch. So in the first case, if the letter was not sealed, then it would seem that you could just open, not doing anything but opening it up. The only way it would be a problem of shaleach yadav would be if you unsealed the letter, right, if it had a seal on it. Moreover, shaleach yadav because it generally means that you did something, removed it in some way which you shouldn't have, in a way which endangered the object, and made your watching of the object less responsible, I guess. For example, you put it somewhere you shouldn't, or you moved it with the intent to take it for yourself, which makes you less of a watchman as well. But if you are just in the course of moving it, from one place to the other without any intent to take it for yourself, so there's no problem with that. Unless the owner stipulated to remain in a specific place in your house, you can move the object. Let's say he gave you a place, a tape recorder to watch, right? So I can move from place to place. If I drop it on the floor intentionally, then I'm a shaleach yadav, right? If I pick it up and I move it intending to take it for myself, even if then I am immediately remorseful, nevertheless, I'm a shaleach yadav. But then, in this case, the guy who's taking the mail never said to keep it for himself, and he was in the course of taking it from place to place. So therefore, it's hard to fit in precisely into the classic category of shaleach yadav because of. Yeah.
The idea that by reading it, he's doing something illicit with the object he's guarded to watch, or he's wanted to guard. Would that be like, I guess, if I sent someone with like a portable video game machine or something, and then he was like playing it as he was delivering it and draining the battery or whatever, but like, and then gave it over, that it would be an illicit use?
Yes, absolutely.
The same idea?
Yes. He's like, since he used it and wasn't supposed to, in that case he's going to be liable for all damages.
Like the drained battery or the loss of information?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's probably, but usually the issue would be if it broke. I mean, otherwise, there's negligible damage, right? But the issue would be if it broke. Normally, let's say a watchman is exempt if something happened, unintentionally, and he wasn't negligent, it just slipped out of his hand, so it's like a Onet
in Hebrew means a, and I translate it in English. It literally means something which was compelled, but here it means something where he was not...
Accident?
An accident. Okay, that's the word. An accident. So an accident, the watchman is normally exempt. But if he was shalech yad, that when he picked it up with the intent, or was actually already using it for himself, so then after that he's liable even for accidents. That'd be the case over here. If he dropped the video game and broke, so then if he hadn't been using it at all, and he was trying to watch it properly, it just happened to slip, so he's exempt. But if he actually...
So because he was using it?
Right, then he would be liable.
Yeah. So that then this would only be allowed for a sealed letter, like you said. Because a letter that's just open, as I'm delivering it,
It would seem that way, right. Certainly in that case, it would seem like it'd be permitted, because what am I doing wrong? I'm not seeing Shalash Chai, I'm just looking at it. So that's not my hand. That's a physical connection or, a physical thing I do to the letter. Or to the whatever object it is.
My question is, do we believe in accidents?
Do we believe in accidents?
Isn't there such a thing as an accident?
Why would we not believe in accidents?
Because I'm talking about one of the ideas of Tachem is that everything that happens to you, anything that happens, everything is completely divinely decreed. And that it should get master plan. And therefore, you can't accidentally... Someone can't accidentally drop something of yours. You weren't meant to have it if someone else...
There was one opinion in Judaism, but certainly not the majority of it.
Okay.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be loads of damages.
No, that's why you wouldn't have to pay if it was an accident.
No, but why do you have to pay? Let's say I'm a thief. If I stole it, it should be mine. God took it away from you.
Because God gave me the rights to my...
What do you mean the rights? Now he took it away. If anything else is divinely ordained that, so...
But God also gave me the laws of how to reclaim with something that was given away, that was stolen from me. Therefore, it was divinely decreed that I used the divine laws to get it back.
Why did he do that? Why did he bother doing that?
Because maybe by going through that process, it makes me grow as a person to have to go through the process of justice.
I didn't have to say that, but it's kind of a roundabout thing, and especially if you go and you say that people then get punished in other ways besides restitution, that they get flogged or whatever, which can happen. So why should they? I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
Well, I'm talking about accidents, not about intentional people things. If I give a computer to someone, they accidentally, by complete accident, just drop it and it shatters. They might understand that that's because God didn't want me to have a computer and have to buy a new one and work for it, or was it just an accident and things happen? Is the idea that things happen, is that in Judaism, or is it, I wasn't meant to have it right now, this was supposed to happen, I wasn't meant to have it?
Oh, schools of thought exist. I can't give you an answer since they're both possibilities. But the idea here of the accident is taken away in any event by the fact that a person was sholeach yad, that he, the tantamount to a sholeach, a follower, in Jewish law, there are four types of watchmen. There's an unpaid watchman, a paid watchman, a renter, and somebody rents, and a borrower. So an unpaid watchman is exempt from payment in any event unless he was criminally negligent. He was negligent, he didn't watch it properly, so then he's liable to pay. But under all other circumstances, he's exempt from payment, whatever happens to the object. A paid watchman is liable not just for negligence, but also if the object was stolen or lost by him. Now, stolen or lost means that if it's stolen or lost as a result of his, not negligence, but as a result of his not safeguarding it even more. In other words, for example, if a thief comes into your house and is able to find the dead object, why don't you keep it in the safe? Why don't you bury it on the ground? But if armed bandits come and they take it away from you, so that even a paid watchman is exempt from that case. That would fall in the category of onus. And onus is an accident before, but it also includes an act of God or something where it was beyond my control. So therefore, a paid watchman is still exempt on things which are onus, things which happen beyond his control. Now, both these individuals are not allowed to use the object which they are watching. By definition, they're only watchmen. If they use it, they're shoreach yad. They're considered to be obviously damaging or literally again casting their hand against their status as watchman or as guardian. A shoreach, a borrower, he actually borrows it for the purpose of using. Otherwise, why would he borrow the thing? So therefore, a shoel, a borrower, since he gets all the benefits, right? In the case of unpaid watchman, he gets almost no benefits. So therefore, he's completely exempt. Case of paid watchman, the watchman gets some benefits, but I'm also benefiting I'm getting benefit by being paid, but also benefiting by watching the thing for him, right? In the case of a shoel, a borrower, so then it's all the benefit of the borrower. It's completely the borrower's benefit. So that's the case. The borrower is liable for everything, including accidents, acts of God and the law. So for example, let's say you borrowed a car, right, from somebody else, right? If you borrowed a car from somebody else and set, while you were driving it, somebody bashed into you and smashed the car, totaled the car, even not, whatever damage it was, so then you are liable for that if you were borrowed the car. If you are watching the car, right, you are a paid watchman, you're exempt for that. If you are an unpaid watchman, you're certainly exempt. But if you're a borrower, you're liable to pay under those circumstances.
What if you're an unpaid watchman of a car? Someone says, watch my Ferrari in my garage for me, and then you go ahead and drive it, but he never gave you explicit permission to drive it.
Then you're a thief.
And you're a thief?
Yeah, that's bullshit and happy because of which you can't know your theft.
Right. Even if you don't damage it, you bring it back in pristine condition, and then he never even knew about it, spiritually you're liable.
But once he takes it back, but once you did that, so you're liable for all damages, including accidents and acts of God.
But no damage occurs, then you haven't...
Right.
What?
Right. You'll do...
You're carrying for 30 miles on the...
I guess.
You are liable to pay for those 30 miles.
So with a letter, I mean, you're not putting wear and tear through the letter. I mean, maybe there's more dust on the letter now than there was before you read it.
Probably less.
Or less, yeah.
Right. No, you're right. It's not a comparable case. By a borrower, he is liable to pay under any circumstance unless one different exemption is if the thing he borrowed died as a result of his using it in the normal fashion. For example, he borrowed a donkey to carry a load. And when carrying the load, the donkey died. And it overloads the donkey. So then that's called Mesa Machmas Lachis died because of the work it was engaged in. In that case, even the shoel is exempt, the borrower is exempt. Because he borrowed it to do work. And the assumption was that it was a working animal. So therefore, if it died when the person was doing work, that obviously there was not what I borrowed, and therefore I'm exempt. Maybe let's say a car, right? I borrow a car, and the car breaks down, whatever the, not through my fault, but the engine runs, whatever it is, the engine brakes, or the brakes break, or something of a break. So that also, I would be exempt. It's called Mesa Machmas Malacha. Unless I had done something to contribute to this debt through the activity for which I borrowed it, I'd be exempt from paying under those circumstances. That's the only exemption a borrower has. Other than that, if a borrower is held up by bandits or, he gets crashed into himself, he's liable under all those circumstances. Now, a socher, a renter, is somebody who actually pays for the right to use an object. So in that case, the situation is not like a borrower. A borrower doesn't pay anything. Everything is a complete favor to him. So he has to accept more liability. But a socher, somebody who pays, should have less liability. That's the reason, because he's benefiting this guy. So therefore, it's a machlokes in the Gemara whether a socher, a renter, has the status of a shomer chinam, of an unpaid watchman, and he's exempt from everything except for negligence, or he has the status of a paid watchman, and he's exempt from acts of God and accidents and all that kind of stuff, but he is still liable for theft and for loss of the object. So the way we constant, the way we rule, is that a socher, a renter, has the same law as a shomer socher, as a paid watchman. He's not on the, he doesn't have that exalted status of an unpaid watchman, he is like a paid watchman. Now again, in all these cases, except for shoel, there is a concept of shoel, and I'm sorry, it's really shoel and socher. In all these cases, including shoel and socher, there's a concept of shoel, yeah. Shalach Yad, when you abuse your watch or your privilege of use. Like the Shalach Chinam, like we said, he takes the car for a ride. Wasn't supposed to. He's supposed to watch even as the watch. Shalach Sofer, that's the Shalach Unpaid Watchman. The Shalach Sofer, the paid watchman, takes the car for a spin. The Shalel, instead of driving the car where on the road, where normally we would expect him to drive, he takes this car and he drives it across the rocks or whatever. Or he takes it off the road, and it's obviously not an SUV, or whatever an SUV is, can't go off the road. So therefore, he took it somewhere where he shouldn't take it. Then, also, he's liable. Even if it dies in the course of driving, he says, well, I was using it. You're using it the wrong way. So therefore, you're liable in that case. So in one of the cases, if he borrowed it to work in the valleys, like to transport things in the valley, and he took it up to the top of the mountain. Or conversely, he borrowed it to transport things on the top of the mountain, he took it down to a valley. In those cases, even a borrower is liable. Why? Because he didn't keep the terms of the agreement. Also, by a soaker, of course, the same thing. A soaker, by the term of soaker, he's liable for gneiva and aveda, for loss and for theft. He's liable for negligence, but he's also going to be liable if he abuses the object, meaning that he doesn't use it in the way he's supposed to use it, right? He goes to rent the donkey, and he uses the donkey instead of where he can use it, he's supposed to use it somewhere else. So all these things, the same thing would be true here, for example, with modern-day rental cars. There are certain companies, at least it used to be, which restricted the rental to, like, to the state. So you weren't allowed to take the car out of the state or out of a certain area. So if you take it out of that area, then you're completely liable, of course, because you were transgressing the specific stipulation of the contract.
Quick question. Does Dina Makutu supersede that? For instance, if the car company, let's say you drive, they say you can't drive out of the state. You drive out of the state and you wreck the car, right? And the car company for some reason says, oh, it's okay, you weren't so far out of the state.
No problem.
You're going to
say that.
No, but let's say there's a situation where basically the halakhic law is that you have to pay them for the damages, but their own law says that you don't.
No, they can be Michael, and they can forgive it.
They can forgive their halakhic obligation?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, any monetary obligation, they can forgive it. Absolutely. So the law is, in this case, that of course you have to make sure not to be shalach yad, not to abuse the watching which you get, and therefore, in this case over here, this person, whoever contended this, this is down from one of the Achronim, said that if you open the letter, it is being shalach yad because of, it is abusing the privilege of you actually watching this thing. Another application of this, however, place where this argument this week is, for example, in email, right? Because I'm not doing anything to his email by reading it. Like, kind of meaningless is my reading his email, because it still remains wherever it was on the hard drive. I'm not taking away his email. I'm just reading it. It's like looking at it. The same thing also, let's say I'm not the agent of the sender, right? The guy who sent the letter has his agent, but I'm not the agent. There's no stipulation made with me, so why can't I read the letter? I'll pick it up and I'll read it, put it back down again. Or not pick it up, as the case may be. But why should it be? And even if you argue that the person who is the agent, the mailman, has this obligation not to read the letter, nevertheless, who says anybody else can read the letter? They're not being shalach yad, they're not damaging any agreement to watch. They never made such an agreement.
They can't use other people's stuff. I can't walk into your house and use your computer.
But that's a yes paper. It's bar mitzvah, I could.
How's it a mitzvah to read someone's letter?
Let's say, I think I was going to accomplish a mitzvah by that. So there's information there which is going to help me do a mitzvah. Right?
Yeah,
bar mitzvah.
But you should be able to read it.
But you're not.
Why?
Because you can't get a mitzvah.
Okay, I mean, you can't read it.
What?
Before the kids read.
Before? Yeah, you could read it.
But by halakha, you would be able to
read it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It seems that way. Except unless, again, if you were the agent who was given the responsibility to watch it. Okay, so going on, the top of the column here. The Yeshivas of some states forbidden, so also Mishum Lotzer of Rachel Ba'amecha. This is an interesting application. You're not allowed to be a gossip. So this is like gossip. It's a very creative application. The laws of gossip usually gossip is when we have a dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. Now when I pick up information from you, but I guess, yes, a similar thing here. There's gossip going on by me reading what's going on in your life. That's different than Lashon Hara. the chilos, the different lashna is something which was, you know, meant to cast dispersion, either truthfully, in which case it's lashonara, or not truthfully, in which case it's mosi shema. But rechilus is another prohibition. So rechilus is the prohibition to go around and gossip, to share all sorts of news about other people if it's to nobody's benefit or interest. So here too is to acquire the knowledge or news of what's going on in the person's life. If it's of no benefit to you, so therefore that would be a prohibition of rechilus of gossip. Everybody wants to say. It'd
be a stumbling block as well, because you're forcing them to stand in gossip mongering?
No.
To say a letter. Like the person wrote the letter, he's gossip mongering if he knows
that he's
going to
be okay? She has answered that the prohibition is with Bakesh, according to the opinion that it's rechilus, that it's gossip, that the prohibition with Bakesh to quest, ulechates, and seek, mistarot shokhaviro after his friend's secrets and to reveal them. Oh! Or perhaps it's prohibited. Mishum shenem rekod says, "Bahavta l'reach ha-kamoha." You gotta love your neighbor as yourself. And you wouldn't want him to read your letters, right? So therefore you shouldn't read his letters either.
That's great.
Okay? And if your master says, "Li alecha," that would use the test. How that tell chaverecha, do not do to your friends. Oh, or another opinion, that sharei to the chlal gineidat bas. This is included in the principle of theft of a person's mind,
which that's a literal translation, but it means deception.
There's why is there a prohibition to say cheat on a test, right?
Why is it prohibited to cheat on a test besides, you know, secular law? You're lying.
What?
You're lying.
You know, you are deceiving the teacher. Not only deceiving the teacher, you're deceiving anybody who then uses your transcript as a basis for, you know, significant. With significant ramifications. So therefore that is a prohibition of neighbor's die. The same thing, you're not allowed to say to a person, you know, if you have an object, let's say you have, there's numerous cases, but let's say you have merchandise, and some of it is very good, and some is not so good. For example, let's say you're selling candies, and some of them are really nice looking, and the others are broken and split and dusty, whatever. So you can't put the nice ones on top, and have so people will come and take. And then actually they'll scoop from the bottom and they'll be taking candies which are not the best candies. That's called neva sas, that's deception, right? It's crushed husband, right? They specialize in neva sas. So new car salesmen are not much better than these cars. From my experience, I've studied it. So.
They just want more money.
Another case of neva sas is say, I know that you're not going to eat in my house. You don't trust my kashrus. I know that. And I come to you and I invite you for lunch. So I'm deceiving you. I'm making you think that I like you and I really want to have you over, but I'm only inviting you because I know you're not going to come. So that also is a form of kneva das, of deceiving your friends. So all these things are prohibited. It's interesting that they're called with theft, because they fall into the category of tricking and deceiving other people. It's taking his awareness, his knowledge of what's going on, and his understanding of how things are. Yeah. It's not. It's an anonymous physical type of theft. It's not.
Okay.
It's based on... Also, it's a rabbinic decree, right? I mean, it's a provision to lie, that's something else, right? But besides it's a rabbinic decree that you're not allowed to steal a person's mind, meaning deceive. So here, there's a letter, the application is not so great, but the way to apply the letter is, of course, to say, if I'm reading somebody else's letter, I'm deceiving him. How am I deceiving him? Because he thought his letter was safe and sound. In fact, no, it wasn't safe and sound because I went and read it. So that is deception and it would be prohibited. Okay? So all these arguments have some weakness to them. And therefore, again, according to Rabbeinu Gershom, before Rabbeinu Gershom, it wasn't specifically prohibited. It was unethical because of all these reasons. It might be gossip, it might be stealing, deception, it might be because you're damaging the guardianship that you receive, it might be because, like we said yesterday, you're visual damage, and it might be because you're borrowing something without permission. But ultimately, all of these, to extend all of these facilities in the case of Rabbi Yosef's letter, is a stretch. And before the Chen Rabbein Gezer, there was no such official stretch made. The first person to come up with the official stretch and say, this applies to Rabbi Yosef's letter, is Rabbein Gezer. Now, as Rabbein Gezer made this takana, as made this decree, says the next paragraph, Abi Gezer Goy, even if a non-Jew sends a letter, Yejmina Chen Shekosu, some of the later authorities write, Shehiz Bechem Rabbein Gezer. You can't read even a non-Jew's mail, right? If you have Tam Shamu, based on the reason which we saw yesterday, somebody borrows without permission is called a thief, and there's no difference in thievery between Jews and non-Jews. And just like you're not allowed to steal from a Jew, you're also not allowed to steal from a non-Jew. So we have the basis. In other words, the basis on which Chen Rabbein Gezer is built is the concept of theft or stealing. So then that would apply equally to Jews and non-Jews. That's also true about the Neva Tzad. The Chen Rabbein Gezer should be Neva Tzad, that you're deceiving, which I read also, the rabbi said, possibly you know that Tabias Tafil Tafil Shogoy. You're not allowed to deceive people, even to deceive a non-Jew. But that's what it goes to. Because of course, if you say, if I have to lay off a kamofa, you gotta love your neighbor as yourself, that does not apply. That's just not your neighbor. You gotta love your friend as yourself, that does not apply to non-Jews. Right?
So, you know that?
Yeah, you probably did.
If I thought of that, I would
general. Yeah, right. See? So that doesn't apply to non-Jew, and also the issue of rechilus. It's not clear if rechilus applies to non-Jew. Lashon hara rechilus, that might also only be between, you know, Jews. I mean, it's certainly not ethical, not a good thing to speak Lashon hara about anybody, but as a strict prohibition, it's only about speaking Lashon hara about other Jewish people.
Is it a good thing to extend the loving neighbors yourself to more Gentile neighbors?
It depends what it means. If it's just a meaningless slogan, then you might as well use it with four physically dogs, too. So that's just what the nature of the statement is. What does it mean?
It doesn't mean you should marry them, but you should, you know, say hi in the morning when you see them face to face.
That's simple. That's the definition. First, you have to define what half the real thought come over entails. It's not so simple, right? People just, you know, brush by it. It's a very difficult statement. What does it mean to love my friend? How does love get to come into this? Right? He's a disgusting, repulsive individual. I have to love him. So it's interesting, you know, people say, I think it's from Rav Kook, he said, Ahavat Yisrael, the love of the Jewish nation, is very easy as an abstract concept. When it comes down to loving specific Jews, it's much, much more difficult. So if I can love the nation as a concept, but it's hard, there are many individuals who it's very, very hard to love because of whatever characteristics they have. So again, Ahavat Yisrael is a very difficult thing to understand. That's what Rabbi Akiva explained it. Rabbi Akiva said, when he wants to find it, he finds a negative. Like his to bring down over here. Sonny Allah, that which you don't like, I'll tell you the Kabir Rav. Don't do to your friend.
And that's universal.
What?
And that's universal.
No, also not. No, also only to Jews. But that could be applied to a non-Jew. You could apply to a non-Jew. It would make sense. But the positive command, if you take it in the positive sense, it's very difficult. We have to figure out exactly, A, what it means before we can go to the next step of applying it. And usually the word the reason why I'm saying specifically to Jews is because it says Re'echa. Re'echa means, always in the Torah, your friend in mitzvos. The person who does mitzvos like you. You're supposed to bond and connect to that person. So therefore it doesn't apply necessarily. It doesn't apply to a non-Jew. It's only it's an ethical extension, but it's not a literal extension. So how do we get on this? Oh, because, right, I said that since it says Re'echa, it wouldn't apply to a non-Jew, and all truth is, it wouldn't apply also to a Jew who didn't keep Torah and Mitzvah. Because the Re'echa means somebody who is like you in the pursuit of, you know, divine service and the worship of God and the acceptance of Torah. So if somebody is not part of Re'echa because he is not doesn't keep Torah mitzvos, so then you would not have that obligation to love that person. Now, why do people say nowadays that it does apply? human people are not.
Can they keep some things?
What?
Please make a little thing that humans live. It will serve everything.
No, everything is the great
pursuit. Not the goal.
Not everything.
Who does that season in another way?
No.
Because they keep some of
it? You got to approach from the other side.
Who's to say that they don't aren't growing?
They don't know better. It's only somebody who maliciously and contemptuously transgresses the Torah.
Okay.
And not somebody who, you know, just doesn't know because he wasn't raised that way.
So isn't it Mavushal line?
What?
With Mavushal and Lomavushal, I heard it also applies to non-Torah observant Jews. Would that also be today?
Yes, in the Seer, the other approach, there are posting like in the Seer. We do apply the Chumrah. So with the Machmir, usually survive within the Seer. Other posting say Taka doesn't apply to the Seer already back in the 1860s. I think it was 1860s. As a Chula to Charleston, South Carolina or somewhere. About wine touched by non-observant Jews. So he said, basically he said, in America there's no such thing as non-observant Jews. They don't know enough to be non-observant. So he said that they're holding by us, and we're saying, well, here we have non-observant Jews. But like, you guys over there, who knows anything? So therefore it's not, you know, not non-observant. He says it's not a problem of them, you know, touching the wine as a result. So the, you know, you have to, in order to be really non-Orthodox, you have to know something first, otherwise you can't do it.
So the leaders of non-observant Judaism who do know a lot of stuff.
Not anymore.
Well, some do.
None.
So a Reformed rabbi would come within the ignoramus category.
Right, yeah, definitely. The question is a conservative rabbi who was ordained 50 years ago.
Right.
And then there are a few of them left. Right. They are literally a dying breed. So the... So
it's better for a non-observant Jew to be completely ignorant of everything and not know what he's supposed to be doing, than it is for him to know what's really going on. And then
is that obvious?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
But so the should you not tell them about stuff?
The students at this yeshiva are in more mortal danger.
A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. That's right. Once you know, it's much more dangerous. That's the way it is, exactly.
So should we not tell non-observant Jews about stuff if we know they're not going
to
do it?
Yeah, you don't tell it's generally worthwhile not to tell non-observant Jews about halacha if they don't believe in halacha existence. Because, what, you know, why should they, if they're not going to keep it anyway, what is the point of telling them about it?
But you should talk about the system as a whole.
Right, you
want
to talk about the system and theology of Judaism, so that's really the way you sort of speak to people and maybe make progress in that direction. But to start speaking to them about, you know, just a Shabbos, about, you know, what you have to, what Boler is, where you're not separated from something, that's really not the place to start. So, you're not really supposed to educate them in that way unless there's a assumption that, you know, they're going to keep the system, otherwise you're making worse than them, absolutely. Okay? So the same thing which applies, therefore, to the letter from Vasilei HaKamocha, even if nowadays they're not observant, they would still be the concept of loving them, at least to the extent that I hear of not opening their letters and the other things which we say, that which you don't like done to yourself, you shouldn't have done to other people. Again, I want to stress, I'm not talking about ethics. Ethics, anybody who opens anybody else's mail is a rotten person. We're talking about legally now. What your halacha allows you to do or doesn't allow you to do. And before came the Rabbeinu Gershom, and according to the Chen Rabbeinu Gershom is not based on theft, but on other things, it might, you can make the argument that it is permitted in the case of a non-Jew.
Is Gershom the guy who also abolished polygamy?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Did he abolish other things?
Yeah. Make 18 decrees.
18
decrees. If you ask me about the other 16, I will tell you I don't remember. But easy to find.
Was slavery one of them?
No, okay, no. Slavery just died his own death. Wasn't,
so with polygamy, did he list a bunch of reasons like he did here before his...
No, he didn't list these reasons.
Oh.
All he said is, also he saw Achigeres Chaveiro. You're not allowed to open another person's mail.
That's all it says.
Everybody is trying to figure out a reason. I have to tell you this, that there was a German Jewish author of the 19th century, whose name was Marcus Lehmann. Marcus Lehmann wrote historical novels. Rav is Talmud Chacham, he wrote a historical novel. And one of the novels he wrote was about Rabbeinu Gershom. And he wrote a whole novel about why Rabbeinu Gershom forbade marrying two wives. And he had a whole story about how Rabbeinu Gershom himself had two wives. And got into big trouble because he had two wives. And for years I believed the story as written there until finally I realized, no, it's all fiction. He actually has no, we have no clue why Rabbeinu Gershom made that decree, and we don't know how many wives Rabbeinu Gershom had, but nevertheless, he made this decree not to marry two wives for whatever reason he made the decree. So the same thing is true by this thing. We're trying to give logic in the claim of Rabbeinu Gershom. We don't know for certain that there's a case of claim.
Why are these
decrees
not considered additions to Torah, you can't add to the Torah.
You want to see the first day. We said that those things which are accepted by the community become binding on the community. Not because he, it's not Rabbeinu Gershom made a decree and it's automatically binding. But rather, it was if it's universally accepted, that's what causes it to be binding. It happens to be if a person of great authority suggests a decree or an enactment, generally speaking, it will be, you know, received or accepted by the community. But as you mentioned the first day, the Sfardim, they accepted the ban on reading other people's letters, but they didn't accept the ban on two wives. So, you know, there is selectivity, and since they didn't accept it, there wasn't the binding of
that. How do people accept the decrees for no given reason? I mean, you just said, no more polygamy.
It's worse than the reason.
And everybody
it's much worse than the reason. Because then people start saying, well, doesn't apply to me. That's what happened to Shlomo HaMelech.
Well,
no, when King Solomon was, King Solomon said, it says in the Torah that you're not supposed to, a king should not marry many wives because they're going to, you know, they're going to lead him astray. So Shlomo HaMelech said, King Solomon said, I'll marry many wives and I'll be okay. I'm very smart. It won't be a problem. Right? So in the end, it was a problem. So the idea is that if you give a reason for something, very often that is diminishes it. Because then people say, well, only applies under these circumstances and not under other circumstances.
So why would that
for example, in this case, then they're going to say, you shouldn't be somebody else that has to cause commercial laws. So then people say, well, it's not a commercial letter, it's just about who married whom or who did what, so then it doesn't apply. So therefore, it's always better not to, you could say the reason, but it's better not to formulate them as part and parcel of the law.
But then why would anyone accept it? Just because he's such a great person that people said, oh, he knows his stuff?
Yeah, the way it must have worked back then, but we don't know for sure, is that there had to be, since Ashkenaz Jewry was so small, you know, what leads to today, as I mentioned the first day, you know, the major towns of Jews had a couple hundred Jews, right? So since Ashkenaz Jewry was so small, it seems like one person of great influence who had many students who were the rabbis in all the little towns, right, would have had very, could influence all Ashkenazic Jewry relatively simply. So that's what the way it seems to have worked with Rabbeinu Gershom.
You couldn't even come up with any decrees you wanted then? If people were just going to follow everything you said?
He was a rational person.
No, I know, but I'm saying, my thought is that if you don't give any, like, because these cognitive reasons sound good, I mean, you have to stretch them, but, you know, if they had given all of these reasons, it covers basically every ground. But if you give nothing, you just says you can't open letters anymore, then why should anyone accept that?
Why should anyone accept it?
Why couldn't he say, oh,
they didn't have to.
You can't eat, you know, you can't eat lamb anymore. I mean,
right, but they didn't have to accept it. But the reality is they did.
Chose to.
Yeah. Not these land. It's not ethics. It has nothing to do with ethics, right? It's the kind of a strange thing to make a takana.
Could be. It's a baby sheep.
The idea, but here, this is something which obviously was, generally speaking, those takanos, those haramim, which we have from the Middle Ages, were made precisely because they were essential for the Jews to live a normal life in exile. So therefore, they're not illogical. They all have something to do with, you know,
so will they be rescinded once Mashiach comes? When we go back to the letter, would we go back to the letter of law? Like, if these takanos are made because to let us live in exile better and not have multiple wives in single wife areas and to be more, you know, not blended in, but to be more, you know, not hated,
then they
could be rescinded later, right?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
And they probably won't be, but theoretically they could be rescinded, yes.
And there is, like, if Paul Israel goes against it can go against it.
Right. If you start a movement, if you started a polygamy movement in Krakow, and you managed to convince most Jews to side with you, so it may well be that you could actually overturn a Ben Gershom's parents.
Open everyone's mail.
Not necessarily going to work. Okay, we'll come back to next week.